Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday, April 12th, 2024 edition of On Iowa Politics. On the podcast this week, the future of abortion access in Iowa, Reynolds puts the kibosh on an AEA bill redo, traffic camera restrictions get a green light, and a slap on the wrist for an Iowa woman convicted of voter fraud. Hello, everyone. I'm Tom Barton, Deputy Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, filling in this week for my colleague Aaron Murphy. And with me this week is the rest of the team. I'm almost a full roster. We have Lee Des Moines Bureau Chief Caleb McCullough. Hello, Caleb.
Hello, Tom.
We also have Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Welcome, Sarah.
Greetings, Tom.
And Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Hello, Jared.
Good afternoon, Tom.
And Gazette columnist Todd Dorman.
Howdy.
All right. First up this week, for the third time in 3 years, the Iowa Supreme Court is preparing to decide whether and how the Iowa Constitution protects the right to get an abortion. Justices heard arguments Thursday in a legal challenge to a blocked Iowa law banning abortions early in pregnancy. Lawmakers last year passed and Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law legislation during a rare special session of the legislature. It would change the amount of time a pregnant person has to seek an abortion from 20 weeks post-fertilization to as little as 6 weeks before many people know they're pregnant. The law bans abortion once cardiac activity is detected in an embryo or fetus, which again can be as early as 6 weeks. It includes exceptions for rape, incest, and medical emergencies. A decision is expected by the end of June. Caleb, you were in the courtroom Thursday. Break down the arguments for us in this case by abortion providers in the state and the Iowa Attorney General's office, which is defending the law.
Yeah, well, the state who passed the law and is defending the law is really arguing at this point that the end of Roe v. Wade at the federal level cleared the way for states to institute abortion restrictions and kind of laid the standard that abortion restrictions should be reviewed with a rational basis test, which is kind of the lowest level of legal scrutiny, and essentially says that if the state has, I don't know the exact legal words, but if the state has some interest in maintaining the law, it should stay in place. And so that was their argument. Before the end of Roe, the state Supreme Court put the undue burden test standard on abortion restrictions. That was kind of in place, the federal standard at that point. And so a couple of years ago, they wrote an opinion that essentially said undue burden remains the standard for now, knowing that those protections would likely go away soon. This was after the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision was leaked before it had been actually officially handed down. So the state's arguing without Roe v. Wade, there's no reason to have that undue burden standard in place, and so the court should allow it to go through. Abortion providers, on the other hand, essentially said that the district court at the lower level did decide correctly because the Supreme Court had put that undue burden place or standard in place and hadn't changed it. And they're saying that the court has every right to keep that undue burden standard in place because the Iowa Supreme Court is not the federal Supreme Court and they can interpret the Iowa Constitution however they want. And so the abortion providers had kind of several arguments as to where they would find a right to an abortion in the Constitution. They pointed to the first article or Article 1, Section 1 that talks about Iowans having a right to safety and to I think a couple other things that I'm forgetting the exact words now, but also that the Iowa voters in 1998 added to that section. It originally said all men are created equal and they added and women. And, you know, they're pointing to that and saying that that is not just a stylistic change. It's an affirmative change that, you know, women have these rights over their safety and their autonomy and that they can find an abortion right in that clause. They have some other arguments, but that was kind of the big overview.
Right. So just to go back again, these arguments seem to break down as to, you know, what type of judicial review or legal scrutiny should be applied to the law. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, rational basis says, you know, as long as there's kind of a compelling government interest to pass some sort of regulation, or I guess in this case, you know, protecting unborn child, that the law would be able to stand. And abortion providers are arguing, no, this undue burden should apply, saying that the law should be struck down because it places an undue burden on Iowa women who are trying to seek an abortion or seek reproductive health care. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. And the rational basis test, now that I'm looking it up and refreshing my freedom of speech class memory, is that the state needs to have a legitimate state interest in whatever the law is governing. And the state, you know, says, and the court affirmed this in one of their previous opinions, that the state does have a legitimate interest in protecting unborn life. So, you know, under that standard, if the Planned Parenthood doesn't have some other way to argue that it fails the rational basis test, which they, I think they are prepared to make that case, but I don't know how well they would succeed, that, you know, the state's arguing that the court, the law should be allowed under that test.
So what questions did justices have for the lawyers in this case? And I guess, how did they respond?
Yeah, it was interesting to hear the questions and kind of where they were leading. If you'll remember in the case, in the Supreme Court decision just last year around reinstating the 2018 law that was the same as this law, but was blocked, the court was split 3-3 and one of the justices recused herself. So there were three justices, and that decision didn't actually decide on the constitutionality of the law. But from the opinion, you can kind of suss out that there are three justices that are, they're less less ready to allow the law to go through. And there are three justices that are pretty much prepared to let it go through. And that came across in the questioning. Justice McDonald asked several questions of the Planned Parenthood lawyer, asking, you know, can you point to any other area where we have a, have something that we have found to not be a fundamental right, but we still apply a heightened level of scrutiny? So he was kind of saying, you know, we as a court have said that abortion is not a fundamental right in the Constitution. So why should we be applying this higher level of scrutiny? Whereas I know a question from Susan Christensen, the Chief Justice, that I found interesting. She asked about the exceptions in the law. And she said, you know, these exceptions for rape, incest, and for the life of the mother, specifically looking at the rape and incest exceptions, she said, you know, the rape exceptions limits, you need to report it within 45 days to be eligible for the exception. And she essentially said, doesn't this close the door on any rape and incest claims? Because anyone who's prosecuted those issues or knows kind of how those issues work know that that's a very small window of time to report those events. And so she seemed to have some questions about those exceptions and say that, you know, they may not pass legal scrutiny.
Interesting. So you mentioned that last time this was before the court, there was a, you had a recusal from a justice. Are they recusing themselves again in this case?
No, she's not. So that's Justice Dana Oxley, and she has not recused herself, and she was there for questioning. So this will be, unless something else happens in the interim, this will be a seven, you know, a decision from the whole court. So it will be, there will be a majority on one side or the other, most likely.
I had the oral arguments on in the background. I was doing other stuff, so I didn't quite. It was kind of like a baseball game, you know, you just have it on back there. But did anyone mention intermediate scrutiny?
Yeah, and that was kind of the Justice Mansfield, I think, was kind of pointed to this issue a lot. The state's lawyer was saying, you know, if this is not a fundamental right, there's no reason to be applying anything other than rational basis. You know, he called it a binary choice, that the court had never found a fundamental-ish or quasi-fundamental law or fundamental right, he said. But Justice Manfield did bring up intermediate scrutiny. And, you know, he said, I the specifics of the legal argument are escaping me now, but essentially said, he didn't say that he doesn't think so, but he, you know, questioned, is it really a binary choice? Can we not apply some intermediate level of scrutiny?
Yeah. Yeah, because intermediate scrutiny was what the court used in 2009 to strike down the ban on same-sex marriage. It wasn't strict scrutiny. It wasn't rational basis or undue burden. They basically said this intermediate scrutiny means that the government has to, government action has to be pursuing an important governmental objective. And in that case, they, the state argued that, well, you know, we need procreation, we need to defend traditional marriage. They brought some experts out that said same-sex marriage was bad for families. And in all those cases, the arguments didn't really hold water. So the So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of getting rid of the marriage ban. So, I'd be interested to know if there, I guess it'll be interesting to see rather that, will there emerge maybe some sort of four justice block that could find something along those lines, a more moderate, not rational basis, but not strict scrutiny, or not, maybe not undue burden, that could still find a reason why this shouldn't be constitutional. But I don't know. I don't know. I didn't get a sense that Jean Oxley was, what's her name? Dana. Dana Oxley. Sorry, I'm in Linn County. I didn't necessarily gather from her questioning that she was tipping her hand too much.
Yeah, and this is my first time listening to these, at least at the state level, oral arguments. And so people talk about trying to decipher from the questions where a justice lands. And sometimes, it was pretty obvious for some of them, for a couple of them. But yeah, it is hard sometimes to know where that leads.
Well, and another thing that I was curious about that you mentioned, you talked about the questioning by Chief Justice Christensen about the exceptions. So I guess I'm wondering, does that leave open a possibility that they would allow the law to go forward, but then just focus, I guess, on the exceptions and changing those and somehow broadening those, or telling lawmakers that they've got to reevaluate that?
Yeah, I don't know, what all the options are available to, in that case, from the way Justice Christensen was talking about it, she kind of was going at it in a way that she was saying, even if we apply rational basis, these exceptions may not survive rational basis, because I think they pointed out that there's some courts that have found that if a law has no exceptions, that doesn't survive rational basis. And so she kind of suggested if these exceptions are arbitrary, as she thought they were, that also may not survive rational basis. So I think she was kind of making the argument, even if they apply rational basis, they could just strike down the whole law because of those exceptions. And I think that's certainly a possibility.
All right. Interesting. And then I guess just lastly, Caleb, to wrap this up, I guess, how did Governor Reynolds, Attorney General Brenda Byrd, and lawmakers respond to Thursday's arguments before the court?
Yeah, everyone's responses, I'd say, were pretty expected. Nobody was making any grand claims. But, Governor Reynolds said that the Dobbs decision in 2022 has returned the choice of abortion to the states, and that Iowa's voters, through their elected representatives, have decided that this is where the line should be drawn, at this fetal heartbeat level. And so she said, she hopes that the court makes that determination and allows that to be to take effect. And the Attorney General Brenda Byrd kind of had a similar statement to make, and said that she would, continue to fight for and defend unborn life. Republican Speaker Pat Grassley, said that he was hopeful that the court would uphold the law. He didn't really want to make any specific predictions, but he said, we felt really strongly about it, and so we're hopeful that it takes place. And Senator Janice Weiner of Iowa City talked, Democrat, put out a statement essentially saying that she thought that the Planned Parenthood lawyers made a very compelling argument, and that she can still considers the law to be unconstitutional.
And the governor didn't show up to oral arguments to loom over the court?
Yes, not this time. She did not. The attorney general was there, Brenda Byrd, but the governor was not in attendance.
Not to venture too far outside of the state, but it is probably worth noting that this is happening in a week where Donald Trump was touting his role in getting Roe v. Wade overturned, and then also said that a near total ban on abortion in Arizona needs to be straightened out. So there is still a whole lot of modulating on this from Republicans at all levels right now, it seems.
Yeah, and I guess that leads me to a question. Todd, what implications will the case and the justice's eventual ruling have at the ballot box? How important of an issue will this be as again, Iowans head to the polls in November?
Well, it will certainly focus, everyone's mind on this issue. And once the court rules, if they uphold the law, we're going to start seeing it in action and hearing stories about people who have complicated pregnancies or other problems that are seeking care and haven't been able to get it. Those are the kind of stories we've heard in other states. Political standpoint, I don't think this is going to bode well for Republicans. I don't know how many voters will turn out to vote on this issue, but it's certainly going to, you know, make it a much more real issue than it's been in Iowa so far, because you had the injunctions have been upheld, the law hasn't been enforced. So really it hasn't had any effect, but it's going to start having an effect if they uphold it in June, and we'll probably know a lot more about the effect by the time people vote in November.
All right. Well, we will obviously continue to monitor and report on that. Moving on, Governor Kim Reynolds this week said she's, quote, absolutely not, end quote, open to tweaking Iowa's recently passed Area Education Agency overhaul to limit how school districts can spend the millions of dollars they'll be taking over from the agencies, rejecting concerns from some House Republicans. So one of the law's provisions will give school districts about $68 million that the AEAs currently receive to provide general education services and media services. But districts will not have to spend the money on similar services and could use it for any school district general fund purpose, according to the law. AEA officials say allowing school districts flexibility over how they use the money likely will result in less funding coming to the AEAs to provide education and media services. The agencies say they've lost a higher than normal number of staff to resignations and retirements this year due to the uncertainty caused by the new law. Governor Reynolds said the law provides local control to school districts to use the money how they think is best, and has previously suggested that school districts could use some of the new money to raise teacher salaries if they want to spend more than the state will be providing them to reach new minimum salaries of $50,000 for starting teachers. Democrats argue the governor is unconcerned about the intricacies of the policy and more focused, on scoring a legislative win. Todd, what was your reaction to the governor's comments, and what impacts do you see as public schools and AEAs, I guess, go about dividing up and using that money?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's really curious that there was this drafting error in the Senate bill that just happened to give the governor exactly what she wanted, which is more, I mean, to let school districts have pretty much, I mean, the lion's share of the revenue to spend as they see fit instead of giving it to AEAs. I know there were some House members that wanted to fix this, and I also figured that they would not be able to fix it because the Senate would say, well, that's okay. And the governor would definitely be anti-tweak, as you suggest. But yeah, so I guess we'll see what happens. The AEAs are losing lots of people. There are retirements, there are departures. People are starting to see the writing on the wall that these institutions are no longer stable. You know, and the thing is, it's gonna end up hurting some smaller school districts because the system is crafted basically so all the school districts in a region pool their resources to provide these services. And if you take larger school districts out of the equation that decide maybe to keep their funding and spend it on something else, you're going to have less money to pool, and that's going to be less access to these services for those smaller districts who really can't provide those services in-house and may not be able to contract for them privately without making, you know, families drive a considerable distance to access them. So I think it's too bad that the bill was not, you know, in accordance with what the House had agreed to, because, it only passed by one vote in the House. And I think there was, you know, considerable bipartisan opposition. But so I guess we'll see how it works. I don't know when is it effective July 1 and then January 1, something like that, I think. So I guess we'll find out soon enough.
All right. Next up, after years of working to regulate automated traffic enforcement cameras in Iowa, with competing opinions on how far to go, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill Tuesday that would require state approval and restrict the cameras to certain areas. Republican state lawmakers have long sought to rein in the use of speed cameras and red light cameras that recently have proliferated across the state. Some lawmakers have argued that they are often abused by local governments to drive up revenue from tickets, but police officials say they are a vital part of public safety strategy. Caleb, you covered the bill's passage in the House. What would it do? How could traffic cameras be used under the bill? And how does it differ from prior attempts to regulate or ban these devices?
Yeah, so this bill is actually pretty similar to a bill that was making the rounds last year, but didn't make it through the funnel. And it requires cities to get approval from the Iowa DOT before installing traffic cameras. And they would need to go through a permit process by submitting an application that they have to document the number of collisions or traffic violations in that kind of area or intersection over a period of time, and what alternative methods they had used to try to control traffic. And then the DOT would have the kind of final say over whether they are allowed to install a camera there or not. And it would also limit actual, you know, ticketing of a traffic violation to cities with a population of more than 20,000. So it's like the biggest 25 or 26 cities in the state. Smaller cities would still be allowed to install traffic cameras if they got approved, but they would only be able to issue a written warning rather than a ticket. And so this bill was brought up after, as you mentioned, a lot of arguments over kind of how much to regulate traffic cameras. There was actually a bill or an amendment on the floor that, from what I heard, was kind of a free vote, in the sense of they didn't whip it, they didn't take a caucus on it. There were a lot of Republicans that were very strongly in favor of fully banning the cameras, and so they allowed them to put that amendment forward, and it got 47 yes votes, all Republicans, so it's pretty big portion of the caucus, but did not get enough yes votes to pass. It actually had 50 no votes, so neither a majority, but it just failed on the floor. So there was a lot of disagreements about how far this bill should go.
And where things stand in the Senate, and what are the prospects that we finally will see a bill pass the Iowa legislature this session? I guess, what are the odds that we'll be talking about this next year?
Yeah, so I haven't talked specifically to the senators that are kind of in charge of this in the Senate, but from the House members that I've talked to, they seem pretty confident that it has support in the Senate. It's made it out of a committee, a similar bill, not a companion, but it's similar enough that they can amend it. There's a decent chance that it'll get done this year, and kind of they'll plant that flag after several years of trying to get this done.
One of the reasons this is interesting to me is it seems like one of the rare kinds of issues related to like police and law enforcement where Republicans don't necessarily line up legislatively on the same side as police and law enforcement. So that's always been striking to me about this, even though we've been talking about it for quite a while. That's something that still kind of interests me with this.
Yeah, definitely. Sarah, Davenport was among the first communities in the state to utilize traffic cameras. Since then, obviously, they've led to intense debate and criticism over the use. I guess, what are people in your neck of the woods saying about this bill?
Davenport, for the past couple years, has supported some kind of regulatory framework for traffic cameras in place of an entire ban. So I think they're really seeing this as as instead of a ban, they'd rather have some regulation on traffic cameras so they can still go to the state. They can apply for these traffic speed cameras or red light cameras at the state level to regulate, to have the state approve it so that they can still have it rather than just like outright banning it. So Davenport's had speed cameras since 2012, and they already, I think one of the measures in the bill was that a speed camera could not issue a ticket for speeders that were going less than 10 miles over the speed limit. And at least for Davenport, they already only issue speed citations to drivers who exceed the speed limit by 12 miles per hour or more. So that's also not really a change for them. So Davenport uses, and Davenport has some statistics about a decrease in crashes at several of the intersections that they do have red light cameras at. So for three intersections that have red light cameras now, they say since the early 2000s, in a 10-year period, crashes decreased by an average of 72%. So I feel like Davenport probably feels like they have a good case for implementing those traffic and speed cameras at the locations that they already have that are DOT regulated. And so it wouldn't be too big of a change for them, and they are in support of the regulatory framework rather than just an outright ban.
All right. And finally, this week, a U.S. District Court judge this month sentenced the wife of a Republican Woodbury County supervisor to a rare split sentence, 4 months in federal prison and 4 months, excuse me, of home confinement. Taylor, the wife of Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, had faced up to 5 years in prison on each of 52 counts of voter fraud. This past Saturday, Woodbury County Board of Supervisors Chairman Matthew Ung wrote an op-ed to the Sioux City Journal that said the sentencing sends, quote, the wrong electoral message, end quote, and called out Jeremy Taylor for some of his behavior during the legal proceedings. Jared, fill us in on this story and what happened last week.
I should note first, I have to schedule all of our online posts for the journal. So when I was first seeing that op-ed that came in, that was quite the surprise to get and be scheduling. As you said, Tom, earlier this month, Kim Taylor received the split sentence, and she'll also have 2 years of supervised release and has to pay an assessment of $5,200, which is $100 for each count of voter fraud, which she was accused of doing to help her husband, Jeremy Taylor, who previously ran for Iowa's 4th congressional district. Something that was notable with the sentencing, before I get to the letter from Matthew Ung, the U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand asked prosecutors at one point if it was possible that Kim Taylor's prosecution, given the large number of charges, was, quote, politically driven because she and her husband are Republicans, and the Biden administration, now in charge of the U.S. Justice Department, is Democratic. It was kind of interesting to hear that point be raised during the sentencing process. With respect to the letter that we got, that was pretty surprising to get because the entire board for Woodbury County is Republican. And they worked together for quite a while, Matthew Ung and Jeremy Taylor. And Matthew Ung said that he was deeply discouraged as a supervisor and ashamed as an American about what happened. He also said that 4 months in a Wasika, Minnesota, low security federal prison, which markets an award-winning cosmetology training program, isn't going to deter any bad apples in either the Trump or Biden camps during the 2024 election. I learned something new about Wasika and their cosmetology training program, so that was kind of exciting. And then he went even further in going directly at Jeremy Taylor and said about the trial. At that point, I thought, why didn't they call Jeremy? Call the dad. Have the man of the house maintain his wife's innocence. Have him say literally anything. Yes, I'm aware of the rhetoric that silence is warranted because he wasn't formally charged, which is ironic when you notice he was as silent throughout the process as someone who was charged would be. And since then, there hasn't been a lot lobbed back. Quite a few folks read and commented on the piece that Ung sent us, but we haven't received anything official from Mr. Taylor, who I should note opted to not run again for his seat this year. So he won't be on the Woodbury County Board next year, but I mean, there are still going to be months and months of them having to serve together before a new person is elected to his seat. So I don't really know how that's going to play out when we have something like this out there now.
Just quickly before we go, some news today in your neck of the woods regarding Congressman Randy Feenstra and his Republican challenger. Fill us in on what happened today and what's going on in that race.
Another fun series of emails to get. basically just reading right from my story now, which is on SiouxCityJournal.com. The two candidates that are competing in the June 4th primary for Iowa's 4th Congressional District, Randy Feenster and Kevin Burgill, they're going back and forth over email about, among other things, former Representative Steve King, what town Kevin Burgill actually lives in, and also support for Israel. Feenster's campaign sent out an email that had a sort of memo giving the state of the race. And one of the sections in the email said, "Who is Kevin Burgill? Kevin Burgill was recruited by former Congressman Steve King, who Randy defeated after nearly 20 years in Congress, to move to Iowa from New York to run for Congress. Burgill hasn't voted in Iowa since 1992 and calls New York his quote-unquote adopted hometown. Burgill also holds positions far out of the mainstream for Iowa. His business has relied on hundreds of thousands of dollars in government contracts and loans. He has praised traitors who leaked intelligence to hostile nations. He has a history of agreeing with politicians who are soft on drugs and weak on the border, and has even praised critics of our ally, Israel." And when I reached out to Kevin Burgill, he addressed each of those criticisms individually. And he said that Feenstra, quote, "lies and twists the truth because he knows that his voting record is indefensible." And I guess I should note in all of this, too, that just yesterday, Steve King was going at Feenstra and touting his support for Burgill. So that's another ripple with all of this.
Jared, other than I know the carbon pipeline issue is a big piece of this campaign. Other than that, I mean, Feenstra is one of there are many more conservative kind of outside the establishment members of Congress, but Feenstra is one of the more conservative members of Congress. What are like the voting issues that Burgill's, you know, attacking him on?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that in particular, Caleb, because in that response that I got from Kevin Burgill, he does not think that Randy Feenstra is one of the most conservatives. He did note that the district is very conservative, but he said last year, the Republican Liberty Caucus reported that Feenstra's record was in the bottom 28% of all conservatives in Congress. So he is trying to go right at the idea kind of that Feenstra is the best representative for a very conservative district. He didn't really bring up voting record stuff about Feenstra, although you mentioned the pipeline thing. And yeah, that was one of the things Burgill, when he reached out to me, made sure to stress was that one of the reasons he ran in the first place was because of the pipeline issue. And he accused Feenstra of working with Summit Carbon Solutions to seize land from farms and landowners. So the pipeline thing has made an appearance now in the congressional races too.
All right. Well, that'll be an interesting race to continue to watch and follow as we near June. Well, that's it for this edition of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us wherever you find your podcasts. And you can also catch us each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. And now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. Lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Free by Tone the Boss will play us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For Kayla McCullough, Sarah Watson, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Tom Barton. Thanks for listening. Girl, you too playful. Unk on the grill, go ahead, get a playful. Got spades on the table. Close the last book up my sleeve is an ace, though. No more chains on my ankle. Had me tied down like a ship with an anchor. Now I'm tied up with a suit and a case full. About to beat the case, got cheese like queso. Can't get enough of the Gazette? Listen to the Gazette Daily News podcast for the latest Eastern Iowa headlines packed into bite-sized stories. Listen at thegazette.com or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or through your Amazon Alexa device. Tell it to enable the Gazette Daily News skill, then say, "Alexa, what's my flash briefing?"